welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn and this is episode number 220 of the podcast, and it's 7th of June 2015 as I record this. So today I have an interview with Mark Dawson, fellow thriller writer, who's had an amazing last sort of 18 months with his book sales as well as his Facebook advertising. And today we talk about how he has achieved so much. Now, Mark's been on a few of the author podcasts, but because he's a like a friend of mine, we're both in England and we're both thriller writers, we do talk about some different things. So I hope you will learn some new stuff from Mark in this interview. And we also talk about his new course for authors on how to use Facebook advertising to boost sales and rankings, as well as make some money. Now, I put a lot of caveats around the discussion as we go through, but it's super interesting and I'm definitely doing the course myself. And the course opens on Friday, 12th of June, and you can find it through my link if you'd like to go through an affiliate link at thecreativepen.com/Facebook. So thecreativepen.com/Facebook, and that will redirect to Mark's Facebook course. But first of all, before we get into the interview, an apology. Amusingly, I promised a show every Monday a couple of shows ago, and I thought I had scheduled last week's show for the 1st of June before I went on holiday, but it turns out I hadn't, and I had a week off the internet. I had 7 days cycling through Croatia, and I checked into Twitter once during the week and realized, and that there was a tweet from some people going, where's your podcast? And I just went, oh, I can't cope with this, and didn't log on again. it was a holiday. Basically, I had a massive last day before leaving, and I was finishing the edits on How to Make a Living with Your Writing. I basically spent 9 hours straight editing as well as packing, and then we left early on the next morning, so I didn't schedule it, and that is no excuses, obviously, but it does mean you get two shows close together. So hopefully that's fun for you, and I know most people don't listen immediately anyway. So I've been cycling in Croatia, as I said, for the last week, down the islands of the Dalmatian coast from Split to Dubrovnik, which was great. I actually really needed it. I had a massive May. I wrote nearly 50,000 words, which for me is a really big deal, actually. For most people, it's a big deal. I know we hear all these interviews with people who just write massive amounts of word count, but most of us are a little slower. So I actually had really bad RSI, and so having a week off writing, I didn't write a thing. I took a journal and I didn't even write a journal because I was so knackered in the evenings from cycling. Gorgeous weather, amazing views, lots of lovely islands and blue sea, and lots of eating and drinking, and highly recommend the Dalmatian coast in Croatia. Great for an active trip, or even just a lying around in the sun trip. It was excellent. So good sort of antidote to writing and computer stuff. And I always think when I'm away, I must do this more often. Like I must take, I'm very good at taking time off when I just stop. So I have no urge to get on email or check Twitter or anything. But obviously there's a lot to do when I get back, but it does make me think I need to take more time off from all the merry-go-round and the rat wheel that we put ourselves on, and just hang out more and enjoy life. So yes, I'm committing to enjoying life more. I am a workaholic, definitely, and I love my work, but I do need some more breaks, because I was truly exhausted. But what I did do is get the two things. So Deviance has now rested, and I'll start editing that tomorrow and then get that off to Jen, my editor. And also I will have How to Make a Living with Your Writing out in the next couple of weeks, because I got that off to Liz, my nonfiction editor, and that is back. So I'll be able to get into that and get it out soon. the main reason I've done that is because Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur, is actually quite advanced material, and really for people who have already written a number of books and are very serious about starting a business and all that. Whereas How to Make a Living with Your Writing is kind of more for newbies, people who haven't sort of committed to running a business as an author, but actually how to make some money. So more for newer writers. Also, I go into things like affiliate marketing and some stuff on freelance writing and other things other than writing books. Also blogging, so that might be useful. Okay, so the new regular segment, which is what are you doing while listening to the show, which I'm really enjoying this segment. I hope you are too. Jonathan says, I listen to your podcast while culturing human cells, which personally I think is the winner this week, that because my little thriller brain thinks, Jonathan, that you are like some kind of Frankenstein, which is cool. Jack says he's listening while illustrating, and the podcast is what inspired him to start doing picture books. Awesome, Jack. And I actually have a picture book that, and I don't usually accept print books because I have a very small flat and I don't read print, but the lovely Meg Cowley has sent me the Wild colouring book because I am an adult colourer. I like colouring in, and yeah, Meg's done one too, so I think it's beautiful. This new trend for adult colouring books is brilliant. Sarah says, I'm listening to the podcast while packing boxes for the big house move out of London. Well done, Sarah, and have a happy moving. I'm personally really happy to be back in London. Even though I really enjoy Croatia, I'm happy to be back in the big smoke. Mark says, I listen to the show while I'm running, which is excellent. And Amelia says, I normally listen to this while fixing dinner or doing other housework, which is when I listen to podcasts generally, is cooking and doing chores. But today Amelia says she's sending out books to the winners of her latest Goodreads giveaway. There's a little marketing tip in there too. Fantastic, Amelia. Actually, I haven't done a Goodreads giveaway for a while. I must do one. Tina says, listen to your last episode while baking bread. Didn't turn out great, the bread, but I love the show. Fantastic, Tina. And Elizabeth says, I listened to your show while painting and sent a brilliant picture of painting skulls, which is super. So yeah, do tweet me or email me what you're up to when you listen to the show, or just send me a picture of where you are in the world, because this travel junkie loves to learn about new places. All right, so this podcast episode is sponsored by Kobo Writing Life, and today I have something a little different, some news about Kobo's partnership with Southwest Airlines. So this is very cool, and something that is starting to happen with ebooks is sort of working with companies to deliver content. So Kobo will offer free in-flight reading for Southwest Airlines passengers, which total around 200 million flyers per year. Passengers will browse books in the Kobo section of their SWA entertainment portal and have the ability to begin reading immediately. Once they reach the end of the first chapter, they will be prompted to enter their email address in order to unlock the remainder of the book. Upon landing, readers will have the option to buy the book. It's unlikely the reader will have finished the book by landing, because the average Southwest flight is 1.5 hours only. Email addresses will be used to contact readers once they leave the plane, encouraging them to purchase the books they started. So I wanted to share this because, well, one, it's, you know, Kobo doing something quite different, and the beginning of seeing this sort of corporate partnerships with fiction on flights, which is awesome. I think this is great, and I'm definitely interested in being part of this. As with any promotions at Kobo, you're more likely to get a chance to be involved if you publish through Kobo Writing Life. So go to kobo.com/writinglife to sign up there, have a look at how to publish on Kobo, and also follow the blog at kobowritinglife.com and the podcast there, which will also give you tips on how to be involved. So that's very cool. And this corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. And it does mean a lot to me. I was talking to someone about this in terms of, you know, financially it's not a massive amount of money, but it's more the principle of the thing. It makes me feel that you as listeners want this to continue. So I'm really happy that, you know, really pleased about the sponsorship on Patreon. It's something I debated doing. If you listen back to the show with Jim Cookwell last year, we talked about it and I said, I really find asking very difficult. And it has been sort of psychologically a massive boost to me, and probably one of the reasons I've gone to a weekly podcast is because you guys have shown me that you actually want this. So that's very cool. So a big thank you to everyone supporting on Patreon, and thanks in particular to new supporters Richard E. Todd from The Golf Rules and to Lorna Reed. And on Patreon, you can support me with just a few dollars or even $1 per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month. So now there's 4 shows a month. It's only 50 cents per show. So definitely less than a coffee a month. And you can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much. And let's get on with the interview with Mark Dawson. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Jan. How are you doing?
I'm good. So just a little introduction. Mark is an internationally best-selling thriller author with the John Milton and Beatrix Rose series, and he also shares his knowledge with authors at selfpublishingformula.com. So we'll be talking about all of that today. But Mark, I think, you know, to some people it seems like you've appeared out of nowhere recently, but you've actually been writing a lot longer. So I wonder if you could tell us a bit about your writing and publishing journey.
Yeah, sure. I'll give the reasonably positive version. I started writing when I was much younger. So I originally wrote something as a middle school student. This is going to date me. So I'd stay after school and use the BBC micros in the maths department. And I wrote this absolutely shocking short story that no one will ever read because I think I burnt it. It was terrible. And then I was first published in 99 or 2000, something like that. So 15 years ago, and with a novel called The Art of Falling Apart. I was a lawyer then, so this was writing about the music industry, because I used to DJ as well quite a lot, so that was some of that stuff that I knew. And then after that, I wrote a novel called Subpoena Colada, so that's kind of set in the legal world again, kind of based on some things that I was familiar with. And, you know, they did okay. I got nice advances. I mean, these days I'd have got, they'd have been considered extremely good advances, pretty good for the time. And then the experience was, you know, disheartening towards the end. We'll probably get into that later. The whole trad pub thing came across, didn't go quite as I wanted it to. So I stopped for ages. And then a friend of mine, this would be 6 or 7 years after that, probably more actually, 2010, 2011, said, you know, about the Kindle, and I kind of did, it was on my radar, but I hadn't considered it properly. And I was persuaded by him, he had a novel published and was doing reasonably well, so I thought, yeah, well, I should try this. This seems like a really good way to get directly to readers, which was always the thing that I'd struggled with the old way of doing things. So I wrote, my first self-published novel was called The Black Mile, which took me about 14 months to write. We'll get on to my accelerations since then. But I put it out. Didn't do all that much. I was a bit lazy in those days, so I just kind of published it and left it there. And then one weekend, I decided I'd use the free days that Amazon was giving, or still gives. And I remember this really well. It would be something like August 2012, I'm going to guess. And I lived in the countryside outside Salisbury in the UK, and it was a beautiful day. The farmer was harvesting his crops. I went out for a long bike ride, and I remember putting my bike down and sitting against a beautiful old oak tree, got my phone out, and kind of by a miracle I had a signal. So I thought, I'll just check and see how many sales I've got or downloads I've had. It was something ridiculous, like 50,000 over the weekend. And this was in the days when free runs were a bit more powerful than they are today. And that was the kind of the light bulb moment for me. It was that this is amazing. Even if only 5% of these people actually open the book and read it, that's still an amazing kind of haul for 2 days worth of me doing nothing at all. And after that, I went into kind of crazy mode. So I wrote another book quite quickly, although it was, again, very research dependent. So it was quite slow for me. So it took me about another 9 months to write it. But then after that, I was getting more sales and I was starting to do reasonably well. And I realized that you needed to produce fast. So I switched into the John Milton series and the Beatrix Rose series, books that I could write without the kind of time-intensive research that I was doing. So I didn't need to go to the National Archive. I didn't need to go to the Colindale newspaper archive to look at 1940s newspapers, all that kind of stuff. I could do it all on the internet. I could kind of use current stories for inspiration and just write. And this would be like 2014 when people started to hear about me. I published nearly a million words in 2014 and went from selling a few hundred books in January to tens of thousands of books in December. So and my mailing list multiplied by a factor of 15 and kind of crazy growth, but it's doable. I mean, we'll probably get into some of the strategies that other people can use to replicate that kind of fast growth.
And then you left your job.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. And this was, it wasn't like a job I didn't want to leave, because I was a lawyer for ages and I did want to leave that because I hate lawyers, basically. Sorry if there are any lawyers listening. I like law, but I'm not so keen on lawyers. So I left that 11 years ago, and I went to work for the British Board of Film Classification. So I was basically a film censor. So for those people who don't know what that might entail, the kind of short answer is I was paid to watch movies and television for a living. So it wasn't a job. I loved it. I would have been very, very happy to continue. No one leaves the job because it's so good, pays quite well, and it's fun. But it got to the stage where, you know, late November, I was making much, much more money from writing than I was from the job. And the way I viewed it was, I liked my job, but I love writing. So once the economics stacked up, and it was kind of, decision was accelerated a bit by, they offered some voluntary redundancy. So I kind of thought, well, I'm going to go anyway. If they're going to pay me a little bit of money to go as well, it's probably the right time. And so, yeah, 20th of November was my last day. Funnily enough, little anecdote, on the 27th, Amazon called me and said, Mark, there's been a terrible mistake with your Kindle account. I thought, no, God, what's wrong? And they'd actually overpaid me by a huge amount. And it was like a five-figure overpayment. But when they called, it was like, oh, God, they're going to close my account then. I just quit my job. And I've got two kids under three and all this stuff. So, but it wasn't that. But anyway, that was... That was worrying.
Yeah, wow. I think we'd all like to be overpaid by 5 million. Yeah. But it's interesting because you talk there, you know, about the advances you had in traditional publishing, and you know, the what's so funny is the definition of success is quite different. I think, I mean, that would be considered a success by a lot of people, but you know, you didn't. From what you've said, you didn't really enjoy that experience. So, and also your mindset has kind of changed a lot, I think. So what are the main differences between that old world of traditional publishing and where you are now, and some of the mindset shifts you've had to go through?
I mean, the main one is, in the old days, you'd write your manuscript, you'd give it to your agent, and the agent would place it, and then that would be that. You'd kind of, that would be the end of your involvement, unless you did like a book tour or you did some publications, some kind of, you know, you went into newspapers, that kind of stuff. That would be the extent of it. And I did do a little bit of radio stuff. They put me on national radio and that kind of thing, which was fun. But my involvement kind of stopped as soon as the book hit the shelves. And that was very, very frustrating to me, because I was like 21, 22 then, so a bit wet behind the ears. But I could still see they were making terrible mistakes. They just weren't doing things that seemed to me to be really obvious. There's nothing I could do about it. You know, I had no input on the cover. The covers were absolutely diabolical. I had no input on any kind of promotional marketing, which was funny because there wasn't any. These were very frustrating experiences, and it was the high point of that was seeing my book on a shelf in a bookshop. Unfortunately, it was on the wrong shelf in the wrong bookshop. So I would kind of move them around and take them from the bottom shelf, put them in the middle shelf, and then the next day, of course, they'd be back on the bottom again. And then the day after that, they'd be gone. So that was really dispiriting. But I mean, the difference, the mind shift now is you can't. I think when I was younger, I had this romantic vision of being an artist and just kind of sitting down and writing 500 words at my leisure while sipping a gin and tonic, all that kind of stuff.
That's
and
my it just,
day. Yeah. It just doesn't work like that. It's not, I mean, some people maybe will be very, very lucky and even, you know, they'll get a traditional deal where it just takes off. So look at Terry Hayes last year with Iron Pilgrim, a very, very good book, his first book, and it's done amazingly well. He probably won't need to do that much again. But that kind of lightning in a bottle situation strikes once or twice a year. And, you know, the odds are astronomical. You know, you can't bank on that. So you've got to work. You've got to, as soon as you type the end, you've got to take one hat off and put your other hat on, and you've got to get onto the business side of things. Of course, those roles are concurrent. They don't, you know, once you start doing the business, those run at the same time. But you've got to be prepared to do everything. And I love that. I love the total control. If anything goes wrong, it's my fault, probably, because I've made an error. So if my cover's wrong, it's because I didn't choose the right one or I gave the wrong instructions to my designer. If, you know, if I'm running an advertising campaign and it loses me money, well, that's definitely my fault because I haven't scoped the campaign out properly, and you know all that kind of stuff is completely down to us now, and I find that liberating. Not everyone does.
And I think that's a good point. I'm coming to the conclusion more and more that this isn't actually for everyone.
No.
I used to think everyone could do this, but I actually don't think they can. I think a lot of people just want to give it to traditional. But you still have an agent, don't you? And you still have, you know, connections into that world, and mm-hmm. you're looking at other deals. So, you know, do you just see that now as the hybrid is the way forward?
Yeah, for me it is. I mean, everything is on the table as far as I can say. If my agent found me a UK publishing deal, including digital rights tomorrow, and they paid me enough, I'd do it. I can work out, you know,
what that would be.
Yeah, and the benefit these days is we can take a year's worth of sales and extrapolate that forwards and think, well, actually, these books are now, I know what they're worth because this is what I can sell. I will sell this many books. Mm-hmm. So if you want to buy my books, you've got to beat that and pay me a premium on that. So realistically, it's probably not going to happen, because for me it would be very high six figures, and probably £1 million to buy those rights from me. So it's not going to happen, because no one really knows who I am in traditional publishing. Probably
I think they might be getting to know you. We're going to come back to that. But let's sort of talk about the speed, because you know, you mentioned the first book took 14 months. My first book also took 14 months. And I've probably sped up to, you know, maybe 4 months. but and that naturally happens as you write more books, I think. Mm. And you mm-hmm. put the hours in, like you say. But you write far more quickly than that. So how did you go? I mean, obviously you said you removed the research, but you still do research. So what are your tips for speeding up the books?
I think kind of from a general position, one of the reasons last year was so fast for me was because I suddenly got a huge jolt of enthusiasm. So I was, and that was predicated by the fact that I was getting a lot of external validation I never had before. So you can measure that in a number of ways. You can measure it crudely by the size of your bank balance and how much you're getting paid every month. That's a good way to keep score. But better than that is how many, you know, you get. I was starting to get emails from readers going, I can't believe I love this book. And I got some last year, just unbelievable. I got one, two, I'll tell you about two. I got one at Christmas time, a guy from Chicago, quite old, I think, sent me a Christmas card saying that I think he said he was 80 and he hadn't read anything for 40 years. And after reading my books, he rediscovered his love of reading. And he gave me a $20 bill to buy myself a gin and tonic with. I mean, that's unbelievable. Suppose I spent that on a book that of mine, signed it, sent it back to him. So that was, you know, the very least I could do. And then after that, this year I got someone... one of my characters, it's a bit of a spoiler, so I won't say, but he's suffering from terminal cancer. And I got an email from a guy, a very, very senior defence contractor in the States who has terminal cancer. And he said reading my books had given him hours of pleasure, and it was accurate. So that's wonderful feedback to get. So I started to get that kind of jolt, which was a great kick up the pants for me. And I kind of sensed that I was on the crest of a wave and I had to strike. That was, if I didn't, and I kind of coasted, which I sometimes have done in the past, then that momentum might pass me by and I've just, you know, I'd be becalmed again. So I had to work hard. But in terms of practically, how can you do it? And there are some ways I'd say that I use that probably are replicable. So I had 3 hours a day because I was still commuting from Salisbury to London on the train, and I've got two small kids. So when I got home, I couldn't write outside of those times on the train. So I can write 3,000 words in 3 hours without too much bother. And the thing I think that enabled me to do that was using Scrivener, and how that enables you to visually see a loose skeleton for your novel. So I tend to start by having a start point, a middle point, and an end point, and then I'll have some kind of action beats that I want to hit in between those points. And then it's kind of, John Cheever said this, writing is like driving cross country in the dark, just with, all you can see is how far your headlights extend. So, you know, you know where you start and what your destination needs to be, and then you just find your way. And that's a pretty good analogy for me. And, you know, if I got bored, if I'm like, I don't feel like writing dialogue today and I want to write an action scene, then I'll just jump forwards in the plot, because I know roughly how it's going to hold together, and I'll write that. Then I might think, now do some dialogue. And then, you know, just being able to jump backwards and forwards like that and be flexible is really great for workout.
Mm. So, and how did you, I mean, realistically as well, you're writing an assassin, basically assassin series, mm-hmm. fast-paced action adventure, mm-hmm. very popular genre. And we, you know, we've got to admit that people who are writing in less popular genres won't sell so many books. But what, you know, how did you decide on the, you know, which books to actually write in order to do well?
I just wanted, there was no scientific formula for that. I just wanted to write something that I wanted to read. So one lesson I can probably impart from what I've done before, after my first two books were published, I was published by Macmillan, and they were publishing a guy called Matthew Riley, who you probably, love him. And he was published by my editor. So I looked at his success and I read some of his books and I thought, that's bloody easy. I could do that in my sleep, right, with my eyes closed. Of course, I couldn't.
Yeah.
I tried to do that, and I thought, well, I'm going to write to the market. These are obviously selling. I want to get into airport bookshops and all that kind of stuff. So I spent probably a year writing this absolutely turgid rubbish that was awful. And for the only time since I've been writing, so in all of my life, it was the only time I actually had to force myself to open the laptop. It was like pulling teeth. I hated it. I think some people, maybe people would be different, but for me, I would say very strongly, don't write to what you think people want to read. Write what you want to read, because it's impossible to tell where the zeitgeist is going to be in 6 months' time. Completely impossible. No one would have thought that sexy billionaires were the big thing that they're going to be before 50 Shades hit. You know, you can't predict those kinds of trends. I think you waste your time if you try and do that, and you end up writing something. If you don't enjoy it, it will be very, very obvious in your prose.
Mm. Yeah, I agree with you. And that's, you know, I often use the romance example. We all know that if you want to sell more books, you write romance and write a lot of them. But I don't read romances, so I'm not going to write romance. And you obviously don't either.
You don't know that.
I've read quite a few of your books. Or maybe you've got another name.
I couldn't possibly say. No, I don't. I have thought about that. I mean, my wife's pretty well read, and she we talked about it once, and because romance is obviously the big genre in every way. I mean, Facebook advertising, which we'll touch on later, I've seen absolutely stupendous results for romance writers. You know, ridiculous results, better than I can achieve writing thrillers. So I was talking to my wife once in the car, and she's read much more widely than I have. And we're talking about, well, you could take a well-known trope or a well-known classic romance novel and update it, which obviously people are doing that all the time. I could write it, we could write it together. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought that was a really bad idea, because I think I'd hate it. It would be very arrogant of me as well, because I don't know the genre. And to think that I could suddenly just go, I know, today I'll write Northanger Abbey or something. It's ludicrous. It would be terrible. I'm much better writing what I know.
I agree. And, you know, I think that respect for the genre is so important. And, you know, when people have a go at romance writers as well, I'm just like, you guys just don't have a clue, because it's very difficult to write within any genre unless you know it. And you talk about Matthew Riley. I love Matthew Riley. Absolutely. And, you know, the Scarecrow books, I do want to write something like that, but I also want to write like The Stand, you know, in the more horror. So I think that's more important to think about who you admire. I went to a literary festival the other weekend, and I was really, it was so interesting, the sort of the empowerment level was probably what I would call it, how empowered indies are compared to traditional. Is that something that you've seen as well, sort of, as this whole thing has changed your level of empowerment?
Oh, massively. I mean, that's just a function of control, and we can do whatever we want. I could, if I wanted to, write another romance novel tomorrow and publish it. If you're traditionally published, and let's say I had a 5-book deal with Simon & Schuster for the John Milton series, and they sell really well, and then on the 6th book it comes around, and I go, I don't know, I really fancy writing a romance. They're telling me where to go, because there's no way that you that would ever work. I mean, if you're like a super name, Stephen King jumps around in genres all the time because he's Stephen King, and Ian Banks, a guy of, we were with the same age, and he went from sci-fi to you know, kind of literature on an alternate basis, and that worked for him. But people, that's a rarity to be able to have that kind of freedom. Where we, you know, we can do whatever we want, though.
Mm.
And if it doesn't work, well, that's our fault as well. But we at least we could do if we wanted to.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. And it's more fun that way, I think. Yeah, the number of authors at this festival were saying, oh, well, I really want to write this, but my publisher won't let me. And I'm like, won't let you? That's ridiculous.
Yeah,
you don't need to ask permission.
Yeah, it's funny. We may have spoken about this before, but you kind of, you go to those kinds of festivals, and I've done that too, and because we hang out with other indies and we immerse ourselves in the indie culture, and I go slightly further than that now, so I immerse myself in kind of internet marketing and all those kinds of things, so understanding things that to me now seem second nature because I do them every day. But when I'm paid now. I consult for traditional publishers, and I'm quite expensive. So they pay for me on Friday. I went in, gave a talk to an agency about the kinds of things that we do now, and simple things like putting a call to action at the front and back of the book. And that's common knowledge now. No indie writer is going to be surprised by this, but you kind of see them going like, what mailing list? What's a mailing list?
We don't want to hear from readers.
I know, it's ridiculous. I mean, but it's not their fault. I mean, and the reason we think it's ridiculous is because it seems so obvious to us, because we've all listened to all the podcasts and we've read all the articles. We're on cables and all these kinds of places where we get our knowledge from, and for people who frequent those places, it is common knowledge. But if you're, you know, you're a traditional publisher and you're probably too scared to, you know, look behind the curtain and see what indies are doing. When you actually are confronted by these powerful techniques, it's kind of like, shit, this is unbelievable. What do we, you know?
What do we do now? But it's also, I was thinking about this. I think it's about skin in the game. I mean, the fact is, for you and I, every book we write, every advert that works, every person that we email with is potentially a dollar in the pocket. Whereas most people working for traditional publishers, their salaries are not based on the sales of any particular book. So actually, when you look, even their sales and marketing people aren't incentivized per book. So I think it's that skin in the game is my measurement now. It's like, how do you make your money? And is it in any way related to me? Which is why we love Amazon and Kobo and iBooks, you know, all the rest, because they make money when we make money. So that's kind of my measurement. But I want to ask you about discipline, because, you know, you worked really hard when you had a day job, you were working on the train. You now work really hard because, you know, you're not a full-time job, but you have more than a full-time job. So how do you balance your time with all these different things? And what are your tips on, you know, actually getting down to it?
I mean, balancing is just, I draw up a to-do list at the start of every day, and I hit and do as much of it as I can. And, you know, I'm particularly busy at the moment, so I'm doing some things outside of my usual run-of-the-mill stuff, which, you know, is fine, but it's a real workload. But, you know, in terms of balancing creative stuff with kind of business stuff, you've got to examine when you're most productive for those particular tasks. So for me, creative energy is very different from kind of administrative energy. So, and I'm best in the morning. So I get up, I'm up at 6 every day, get my kids off to nursery, and I'm usually writing by 8. And I'll write through until that kind of that creative muscle is a bit tired. So maybe I'll write through to 11 or 12. Then I'll stop. I'll probably go for a run. And then I'll come back. I might do a little bit more if I'm in the flow of things, but if I'm not, then I'll start to do all the admin. So I'll look at advertising, I'll look at answering emails, corresponding with readers, all that kind of stuff, which I love everything. I love it all. But it's, if I did it the other way around, I'd be spent by the time I needed to use that energy to write stuff, which at the end of the day, that is what pays the bills for me. It's writing new, fresh stuff that I can then sell.
No, I agree. So you say you love everything. Is there anything that you don't like doing, like in everything that we do?
No.
No.
I don't think so. I mean, some things, Okay, something a little dull.
Or that you've tried and that then you've stopped doing because you didn't like them.
No, not really. The only thing I found a bit of a chore, and I could probably systematise this so I didn't have to do it so much. I give away a lot of free books as an incentive to get onto my list. And I advertise that, and it's on, you know, the CTAs are everywhere to drive people. And I probably add 150 people to my mailing list every day at the moment, so that's great. But a lot of my readers, and I know this from surveying them, they tend towards the older end of the spectrum, and it's... to sideload something is not straightforward for everyone, and that's completely fine. I mean, it wasn't straightforward for me the first time I tried it. What do I do? Where's the file gone? It's not where it's supposed to be. So that can be testing. And I, in the email that goes out, I say, look, if you have any problems, please email me. I don't mind at all. I actively encourage it. And so people do email me quite a lot. So I'll probably have 5 or 10 people a day asking me for help to get them onto their device. And it wouldn't just be the Kindle. You need to know for everything.
Yeah.
Or you know, PDFs or, you know, so you, I provide as much as I can. There are links to, I mean, things like send to Kindle, Amazon's funky little email system to send stuff to your Kindle. That's been a godsend because it's made it a lot easier for me. But I'll get people coming back to me 3 or 4 times saying, I can't do it. I've had some people say, it's impossible. This is a scam.
Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of like, oh, come on.
I've had the same thing, and I think you're right. It's just, it will get better, I'm sure, over time. But right now, people, you know, I'm sure some people listening don't know what sideload means. It just means getting the book onto your device without it magically appearing, right? Where has the file gone? It's in your download folder.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, you have to diagnose that sometimes with limited information, so it can be difficult. But then the other thing, my wife is always saying to me, you need to get an assistant and you need to get a VA. And I'm not against that, but a lot of the management and administrative time is corresponding with readers who've sent me nice emails. And I would say one of the best pieces of advice I would give is, like, if you have to reply to every single piece of it, and you can't send canned responses because it's obvious. You can't get someone else to do it for you because that's obvious too. So you have to do it yourself. And that is a definite drain. And then there will come a point, probably not miles away from me, that when I just can't do that anymore, because I'll end up doing like 2 hours of that every day. And I don't, unfortunately, there are only 24 hours for me to be, well, you know what I'm saying? It's difficult. And I'll have to do something to pass that off. But I'm fighting as hard as I can, because I think one of the reasons I did well last year is because I'm converting all of those people who took the time to write to me. I'm turning them from readers into fans. And then I'll offer them a chance to be on my advanced team so they become super fans. And by the end of the day, hopefully they become friends. And, you know, I think that was the process that did most to push me forwards last year. Mm. And I don't really want to give that up. But, you know.
No, I agree. I think actually the one-to-one email between you and your fans and me and my fans, you know, is so powerful, and I spend a lot of time doing it too. And actually it's brilliant because, like, I know, and I've got little notes on people, like what their dog's called.
You're good.
Well, only with the super fans, you know, because some people, you know, you just learn more about them over time. And I love to, like, one guy was in Alaska and he sent me a picture of him on his snowmobile picking up the parcel of my books. And I'm like, that's super cool.
That's very cool.
It's really cool. So to find out stuff like that is just great. But you mentioned they're adding 150 per day to your list, and everyone's going, ah, that's ridiculous. So can you give us some, you know, how are you adding, or how did you start with adding people to your list, and how do you do it now?
The starting point is you've got to have a call to action everywhere you can get it. So by call to action, I mean an invitation for people to join your list, and you incentivize them with something that, people we've both spoken to Nick Stevenson before, and
he's been on the show, so you can just give an overview.
Yeah, exactly. So I was doing this a long time ago, and it works. So you give a reader magnet, give a book away, or for me, I give away 4 books. It depends on whatever you can give away. You give something away to incentivize them to bribe them even to join the list, give you their email address. When I started doing that, that worked very well, and then I had some permafreeze that started to sell or be downloaded in very high numbers, and so that is always going to be at the front and the back of the book. On every Amazon page I can get it on, it'll be there, it'll be on my author page. I've got a video on the author page of me telling people, please, you know, have some free books. So you do that as much as you can. And then if you get something like a BookBub deal or any kind of advertising where you suspect you'll be driving a lot of eyeballs onto your page, make absolutely sure that the page has that front and center. I'd much rather take a subscriber than a sale or download, because once I have that person in my list, then I can start to market to them in a way that I control rather than a way that the retailer controls. So it's just a much better idea. So that would have gradually increased. I did a few contests that give a big jolt of subscribers, but I probably wouldn't recommend that anymore because, for obvious reasons.
Freebie seekers, yeah.
You're not getting readers necessarily. You get some. You get a lot of people who will unsubscribe en masse when you send them something that isn't free. And you want to avoid that. I've had my MailChimp account suspended before right at the start when I didn't know what I was doing. And for that to happen now would be a serious problem because that's my big asset is my list. But these days, the thing that I've discovered since Christmas really that's worked really, really, really well is Facebook advertising. So that is, it's like a nuclear weapon when used properly. Mm. And I've started to teach people how to do it. But one of the things I started, I think in January the 29th it was, and I did a 6-week campaign. I spent $2,000, something like that, and added 4,500 subscribers. I've dialed it down to about $10 a day now on that campaign, and I still add 30 or 40 subscribers a day, even at that low level. And they're somewhere in between contest winners and readers who've come in after reading a book. So they're cold. I'll say they're not cold leads, then they're not warm. They're somewhere in between. They won't be quite as reactive in terms of buying behavior as others, but they're still quite good. And I've done the sums and they certainly bring me more than I spent to acquire them. So that works well. I mean, one guy I had, he's been following some of the things I've been teaching, exploded his list from, he had 27 people on his list, and he said it took a year and a half to get 27. He's got 2,600 now, in like a month, which is, it's amazingly powerful.
But I mean, and that's getting, I would agree with you. I don't think getting people, like if you have a decent giveaway, and most people won't have 4 books to give away, but you know, even if you have one, if you have a decent giveaway, a nice landing page, easy sign up, then getting people on the list is easy enough, I'd say. But
yeah,
keeping people on the list and keeping them warm between books, especially if you're not putting out books regularly, what's your advice for what you do with those people? Because so many authors don't know what to talk about to their list, or you know, how to keep that list warm.
Yeah, I mean, you can get different advice from different people, obviously, on this. And I've read plenty and seen plenty of authors who will email them every week. Definitely don't know. I don't do that.
I wouldn't do that, no.
I wouldn't know what to say for start, and I know that if I was receiving those emails, I would unsubscribe very quickly. So I don't do that. I probably don't even email every month. I'll email them when I've got something that they might like. So, I mean, recently all of my Milton books were published or audio booked by Audible. So Audible bought them and then released them all at the same time. So I'll tell them about that because I know that a lot of people are asking me when the audiobooks are available. So that's good information for them. If I've got a promotion on a book bub, I'll tell them that it's 99 cents for a couple of days. And I'll definitely tell them there's a new book coming out. That's my limit. The only kind of difference, the only exception to that is my street teams and my advanced list. I've got about 800 people on that, and I'll tell them things more often. And I'll ask them for things more often as well. So they get everything. They get all the books for free in advance. And those guys are completely amazing. I love all of them. Like my children.
Maybe not quite the same.
No, not quite. But that was another of the main things I learned last year was leveraging readers in a street team like that, because I remember back in the day I couldn't get reviews. It was impossible. And you need sales to get reviews, but you need reviews to get sales. Like, how on earth do you solve that problem? And the answer is you get a street team and you build them up over time. And the last book I launched it on a Friday. By the time I kind of properly launched it on the Monday, I had 150 reviews and I think 140 were 5-star reviews. So that's just remarkable. And, you know, I would have sold my grandmother down the river for that if someone said that was possible. So I will email those people more often and I'll ask them for things. So if I want to get a book bub on a book that doesn't have the kind of the number of reviews I think it probably needs, I tend to look at 100 as a minimum, although you can less is possible. That works for me. If I've got 50, then I'll email them and say, look, this is what I'm doing. And if you explain why you're doing it and why it would be amazingly helpful of them if they did it and how grateful you'd be, people tend to, they don't surprise me anymore because I've come to expect it, but they're people and they're nice and they're good. And and they'll do something like that because they can sometimes feel invested in your career as well. And that, you know, if you're giving them books to critique early on, they feel invested in that book. Especially if you tell them that a change they suggested has now been published, which I do all the time. So those guys I'll email more often, but probably even with them, no more than once a month.
Yeah, no, exactly. And to get those street team, you have an autoresponder series, right? Where you tell people things when they automatically sign up.
Yeah, there's a series of emails that go out. So when the four books that go out a day at a time. And then I'll start to, I mean, the autoresponder is switched off for the team now because it's got like 800 people and that's probably enough. But when I've got vacancies, that opens out and I'll get people, you just say, you know, would you like to get the books for free in advance? I don't say that it's dependent on anything.
Yeah.
You'll see some writers who will say to stay on the team.
Yeah, I know. Hardcore romance authors.
Well, I'm not going to criticize them because they know what they're doing, but
they do.
That wouldn't work for me. Apart from having the administrative faff of checking, I don't care about that. I'm quite happy to give them a free book. And I mean, this is how cool they are sometimes. They'll, apart from critiquing it and fact-checking it and stomping on any typos that have got past my editors, when the book is launched, they'll buy it too. Because I say, when I tell them it's ready for reviews, I'll also say, if you're able to buy it, I give it to them at 99 cents. If you're able to buy it, your review is verified and will carry more weight. And it'll be great for me because it starts to trigger the Amazon algorithm. Because if I've got 800 on the list and 400 buy it, 400 is enough
to
get you
high.
Well up, yeah. You know, well into the top 1,000. And then when you hit it with your main list, so I then hit it with, say, 20,000 people, I can launch into the top 200 now without too much bother most times. And if you, it's like, as long as you explain that why it's important, then people will do amazing things for you.
I think, that honesty and, that's, I think, really important, and kind of being humble but still asking. You know, I think I've learned that from you, and I bought Amanda Palmer's Art of Asking book and I'm reading that and trying to, I think it's partly a personality thing, partly sort of an author thing of feeling like you have to, you know, you don't want to ask people, you think your book should be good enough that they will do it anyway, but they just won't. Often you know, this call to action idea that you have to ask will make a big difference. But I want to come back on Facebook, because you're doing a lot of Facebook advertising. It's like the trendy thing right now. It's become the big thing. And you've got a course, free videos that people can get at selfpublishingformula.com. Now, I gave it a go. You know, you showed me and I gave it a go. And it's so funny because it makes me miserable. It makes me so miserable. I don't like Facebook. I've said many times. I don't like being on Facebook. I love Twitter. So when I go on Facebook, I feel totally negative, just the whole experience. And I know that, you know, to be successful, you really have to be in there and tracking things like you do very, very well. And part of me thinks, don't be such an idiot and just knuckle down. And then part of me just goes, ooh, but I don't want to. So tell, you know, for people who do like Facebook or people who are willing to double down and do it, what are some of the, you know, sort of top things they need to do to get Facebook advertising right?
Well, I look at two. There's two objectives that I look at the moment for advertising on Facebook. The first one is driving mailing list signups, and the second one is driving sales. So, for mailing list signups, you need to have a good offer. So, you need to give away something of interest. You've got to target that ad really specifically, and that's the thing about Facebook, which is so stupendous, is how laser focused your targeting can be. So, I could target, you know, if I was selling. My books are compared to Lee Child a bit, so Jack Reacher, John Milton, of similar kind of characters. And I can target my ads to people who Facebook knows, like Lee Child or Jack Reacher, who are between the ages of 40 to 45, female, living in San Diego, if I wanted to be as precise as that. So targeting is really, really key, and there's some amazingly funky things you can do with targeting, like building lookalike audiences and custom audiences off your website traffic, all this kind of really cool stuff. So you've got to get that right, and that's the technical stuff, and that's the kind of the bit where the blood comes out of my ears sometimes. But I like it; it's fun. So you not so much the blood coming out of my ears, but you know, you kind of you work at that. then you've got to think, where's the traffic going? So it's got to go onto the landing pages, as you said earlier. So your landing page has got to be really congruent with the ad, so it's not a kind of, there's no dissonance between the two experiences. And you've got to make it very, very easy to sign up, and the language has got to be right, so you don't say things like, give me your email address, or even worse, an email box where you put in the email address and then submit. I mean, that's
because,
I know, it's ridiculous. You don't think about it until you actually think about it. Actually, that's not the word I'm trying to use there. So the way to say it
BDSM
is
BDSM erotica.
Massively, yeah, exactly. So for some genres, it's probably perfect, but not for the ones that we're writing. So I'll say, like, where do you want me to send your free books? So you present it to them in a kind of a giving way rather than a taking way. So there's a bit of psychology involved, but it's not difficult. So there's that. And then for paid sales, it's all about, it works best with box sets, because there's an expense for advertising that needs to be defrayed by a higher royalty item. So I tend to sell $6.99 box sets that give me $5.20 from Amazon, and I can get clicks at around about 20 or 30 cents per click, and I can convert those clicks at around about 10%. So those maths, when they add up, it means I've got to sell one every 11 or 12 clicks. And if I'm converting at 10%, then I'm beating that. So I'm going to be making every click, or every buy after that one buy is making me profit. So I can reasonably reliably every day double my money on Facebook advertising. So I invest $300 today and I take $600 back, which is, you know, if anyone knows of a way, anywhere you can get that kind of return, please tell me, because I'll be on that like a dose of salt.
And the reason you're getting that is because you've spent a lot of time optimizing every part of that chain.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's got to be the right targeted advert, the right audience, you know, the right, the right landing page, the right offer. There's a lot of things that have to be exactly right for things to convert at that level. And what, when I kind of went into it, it was like, oh my goodness, you have to get to that point. You have to test so many different variations to get there. So how long did it take you to optimize, to get in there and optimize it?
Probably 6 months, I'd say. Yeah. So that's how long I've been testing and spent a lot of money as well to get to that stage. And I know what I'm doing now, and I'm spending enough money now. I've got a Facebook rep, which is quite cool. So she called me today. They basically just called me to make sure I'm still going to keep spending the same amount, I think. So you're like, well, I'll call you next week as well, Mark. And if I've got any questions, it's really helpful, because Facebook can be a bit impenetrable to see how their algorithms work. But yeah, I taught myself how to do it. I listened to a lot of podcasts. I did a lot of testing. I read lots of articles and books and that kind of stuff, and I do quite like spreadsheets and stuff like that, which is not for everyone. But you do need to have I think if you don't enjoy it, then maybe get someone else to do it for you.
I have been thinking about that, but then to pay somebody else to do it for you, then you really have to have something that converts well, because your profit will be lower. But there's been changes with one of the big problems with Facebook. I mean, I think everybody knows now it's a pay-to-play platform. Like, it's really changed. Like, there's almost no point in having your own page, trying for organic traffic just doesn't work.
On organic stuff, it definitely has changed. So, like, a year ago, if you did a normal post, you'd probably get penetration of 20 to 30% delivery to your fans. It's probably about 2 to 3% now. So they've really throttled it. But there are ways to bring that up again. So if you get high engagement on your post, so one of the things I do every Thursday, I have Throwback Thursday on my fan page, and I put stupid pictures of me as a child up.
How do you have all of those? People didn't have cameras when we were young.
my mum's kept everything, so she's got loads of these things. So my dad scans them, I put them up. And I'm not afraid to laugh at myself, but they get massive engagement. So, I've got, I think, 5,000 people on my face as Facebook fans. And the last one was seen by a fifth of them. So that's great. And so that means the next time I post something, Facebook knows I'm an engaging poster. So that means I get a bit more organic reach than would normally be the case. So you can kind of, it's not gaming it. I understand where they're coming from. They want, it's all about the user experience of Facebook. So they want people to get the kind of stuff that they like, and engagement is a good way to demonstrate that. And that's also true for their ads. I mean, ads are cheaper the more engaging they are. So the more likes and shares you get, the cheaper the CPC, cost per click, will be.
Really? See, and this, well, what I was going to say was about the algorithms, given that they change things so regularly, things that might have been working one day, then just stop working. So you have to monitor it like every day, really, don't you?
You do. I mean, I before we got on call, at 2 o'clock, I always check. I just check. It doesn't take very long. I check on Facebook for basically what the clicks are costing me. And I use affiliate links on Amazon to confirm that those links have generated a number of sales. And it's just a question of dividing one by the other to get your, you know, your ad spend and your revenue. You can find the return. And so as long as I keep going in the black, I'll keep spending the same or maybe increasing a bit, you know.
Mm. We should also say on the cash flow, obviously you have to pay Facebook when you hit a limit or at the end of the month. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
Whereas you get your income from Amazon
60 days later.
So you have to be really careful with cash flow on this too.
Yes, and that's a good point. One of the people in my group, she is just amazing. She had a box set. She's an erotic romance author, so she's in that kind of sweet spot of a hot genre. She was making, I think, $200 a day on this one box set. And last month she made 18,000 after doing what I suggested. But she had to stop because she couldn't afford
the cash flow.
It's a cash flow thing. So she'll get all that money in 2 months' time, and in which case, if she's sensible, she'll
turn it back on again.
Turn it all and probably, you know, take half of that money, reinvest it, and then double that, and et cetera, et cetera. But until then, she's got to turn them all off. So that must be very frustrating. I'm a little more fortunate than that because I'm making enough from, you know, general sales to be able to not worry about that so much.
But I think it's important for people to know, like, you have all these things, you have to be very careful. You can lose your shirt
on
advertising.
You definitely need to have that disclaimer. It's not easy and it's not guaranteed. So, and Facebook is really, really good at just charging your credit card. Right? Yeah. but as long as there are a lot, it also gives you lots of information. So it's not disruptible in any way, as long as you are sensible.
You know, I'm very risk averse, so I've made the point. Everyone has heard. We've put some disclaimers around this, but you do really well and you are helping people do really well. So tell people about the self-publishing formula course and, you know, what they can find there.
Mm-hmm. At selfpublishingformula.com you sign up and I'll give you, I think, three videos that will demonstrate and in a way that's actionable, so not holding stuff back, how to use those ads to blow up your mailing list. So that's the information that guy I mentioned earlier used to go from 27 to 2,500. And none of that is paid. It's all available for free and anyone can take advantage of that. But the full course, which I think will be available when this is live, will be much more in depth and will cover the thing that probably most people are most interested in, is like making money from advertising. So how do you sell box sets? How do you sell lower price items? Is it possible? Where do I get good images from? You know, loads of stuff. It's really, I've been working with some guys from the BBC who are doing all the technical stuff because I'm much too lazy, and they're better at it than I am. So it looks really nice. I'm proud of it. I think it's got a lot of really useful stuff that I would have paid a lot of money to get, because it would have short-circuited all that research and expense that we mentioned earlier to get to where I am now. It's not a slam dunk, but it will shortcut a lot of that hard work.
Mm. And I mean, it's called self-publishing formula, but is it about the self-publishing, or it's mainly now about paid advertising?
There'll be other courses, but I think that's the brand. Self-publishing formula will be the brand. To be honest, when I scoped it out, I was going to do something much, much more ambitious, like a real A to Z, and I completely underestimated how much work it was. So after kind of banging my head against the wall, the thing that everyone wants to talk to me about at the moment is Facebook. So that's a pretty big subject in itself, and it just made more sense to concentrate on that. That's definitely where the demand is. If it does well, then I'm very good on launching books. That's another thing I'm quite pleased and proud of. And perhaps I'll be saying on launching or mailing list or all that kind of stuff. But for now, it's a focus on advertising.
Mm. And I think it's great that you recognise that. And I've done courses too, as we've talked about. And what's so funny when you try and break down what you know is you realise that you know quite a lot. And I, again, circling back to the traditional publishing people at the literary festivals, there were questions like somebody said, you know, well, I thought you make more money from print books than ebooks. And it's just like stuff like that, basic things that we know, that we've learned as indies, so many, you know, people just don't know. So when you try and teach it, you realize how much we've learned over the years. So I hope everyone listening, give yourself a pat on the back, you know, how much we've all learned in quite a short amount of time. Essentially, we're running this business that is pretty much the same as a traditional publisher, but better.
Yeah. We are in the vanguard of a revolution. And that's the way I look at it. There's too much momentum now for this to change. This is the way publishing will be going forward. That, you know, we look at author earnings, it's obvious that that's happening. And we are right at the front of that. Even if someone listening to this has just listened to the, for the first time, you're already ahead. The fact that you found a podcast like this, you're already ahead of probably 95% of the industry. You know,
and it's hard to remember that because, you know, I've been doing this since 2008, you know, back in the day with Lulu, you know, before the Kindle and everything. And it's kind of weird to think that we're, you know, at the front. But I agree with you. I think we're still in the toddling years, I would say. We're still early. But in terms of global, you know, we haven't even started on the global kind of scene, have we? I mean, it's crazy what's gonna happen. Actually, and talking about that, because I met quite a big name author. Like, what's starting to happen is these big name authors are starting to go indie, and they might not be talking about it publicly yet because they're still embarrassed and they don't want to piss off their publishers. But what he was saying, interestingly, was watch out indies, because once the big names start putting their backlist up, we will lose out to the big names. So stop telling everyone about it. What do you think about that?
Shall I be polite? I think that's...
Try not to swear. But
I won't swear too much. No, I don't mind competition. It's fine. You know, if he or she prices at $4 or $5.99, I'll price a dollar less than that. You know, there are things coming down the track that are going to make it more competitive, and that's absolutely for sure. But it's not as if there are a shortage of readers.
No, they're growing every month.
Exactly, and you know, I'm very enthused about it. You mentioned, you know, different markets, things like, you know, Germany, that's probably the next one. But you look at China, Brazil, Nigeria, exactly, all these places. And as you've mentioned before, and it's absolutely right, skipping desktop, going straight to mobile, straight to having a book in your pocket by one press of a button. It's a massive expansion of the readership, probably unprecedented in human history in terms of getting content to readers with no friction. It's, you know, that's very, very exciting. And my view is, I think you're right, there's definitely going to be a big author, and by which I mean like a really big author. If I was Stephen King, I'd be going like, why am I giving them? He's probably getting 30% as a royalty, something like that.
He's probably getting much more. He probably gets like 70%.
Yeah, exactly. But there was someone of that kind of stature who's getting, you know, a significantly less than 70%. More, you know, and but at some point they'll think, why do I need them to do that for me anymore? I'm not, you know, maybe I'll need to hire someone to take care of the technical side, but I'll be very attracted by the difference in those royalties. And it'll only take someone of that kind of ilk.
It's funny though, because J.K. Rowling has done this, you know.
Any
J.K. Rowling ebook goes straight to Pottermore, which is her self-published company, essentially. Yeah. So, but people forget that, I think.
I mean, I have forgotten it. And she's a visionary and good for her. That was extremely prescient on her part.
Exactly, but yeah, another big name would be good. Yeah.
The thing was that wasn't really kind of a massive news story that she'd, like, say Barry Eisler, for example, turning down $500,000 to go indie. That was a story, but think of what that would be like when, you know, someone of King's kind of standing goes, actually, I'm going to turn down $3 million or more, however much he gets. Or James Patterson suddenly goes, I'll do this myself now, and he's the kind of guy who'd do it. And just put it out himself, and then that could be the kind of another tipping point. We've had a series of tipping points, and that might be the next one.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I mean, what I love about our kind of movement, it's pretty much a movement now, isn't it? You know, is that we are also positive and, you know, glass half full, glass almost completely full type people. And I it's a brilliant time. So, right, where can people find you and your books online?
Okay, so if it's kind of for books and to see how I run mailing lists and you know, branding and all that kind of stuff, then go to markjdawson.com. For the course, it's selfpublishingformula.com. And, you know, if you want to get in touch with me, I do answer everything. So if you join the list and just reply to one of the emails that you'll get automatically sent, you'll get a personal email from me. Unless my wife beats it into me, I can't do that anymore. But for the foreseeable future, it will be me and not some VA in the Philippines.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for your time, Mark. That was great.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.